Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. When the Supreme Court ruled on Friday to legalize marriage in all 50 states, Americans erupted in celebration. More than 26 million people on Facebook used the rainbow flag filter to express their pride in the ruling, and uses of the hashtag LoveWins flew thick and fast through social media. But in Chicago, a group of mostly African-American activists wearing T-shirts that read hashtag Blackout Pride interrupted the Pride parade there on Sunday with a die-in. In a statement published online, the group said, "We stand in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement and demand the permanent abolition of the racist police state. The queer community must call for an immediate end to racist policies that make trans and queer people of color into the targets of deadly state violence," end of quote. The action highlighted the challenges of intersectional politics reflected in the rumblings from those who say that while it is wonderful for the Supreme Court to legalize marriage, they're waiting for the day when the court will legalize being Black in America. My guest is Patrice Cullors. She is the director of the Truth and Reinvestment Campaign for the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. She's also the co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement with fellow organizers Alicia Garza and Opal Tometi. She also founded the LA-based organization Dignity and Power Now. She's an artist and an activist and a Fulbright scholar. She was named the 2007 Mario Savio Activist of the Year. She received the Sidney Goldfarb Award and earned a degree in religion and philosophy from UCLA. And she joined us for the first time last December. She is now back in studio. I'm so glad to welcome you back to the program.
It's good to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, you were saying right before we went on the air how much has happened since the last time that we had you on. And so I hope this is an ongoing conversation that we can have with you here. So first, let's begin with the Supreme Court decision, which came so soon after the nation was mourning the deaths of nine African-Americans in this terrorist attack by the white supremacist Dylann Roof. And in fact, it was on Friday, the same day that Reverend Pinckney was laid to rest in Charleston, that the court ruled on gay marriage. And I'm wondering if the proximity of the tragedy to that celebration has created this conversation, or has sort of prompted this conversation of two movements that seem separate but probably shouldn't be.
Yes. I mean, the unfortunate reality is that the LGBT movement, in large part, has neglected the fight for Black lives. And what you've seen is a significant amount of Black folks on the front lines who are queer, who are trans, that have said the LGBT movement does not speak for us, because mostly it is led by white, upper middle class gay men who have an agenda that's specifically about assimilation. And I think where Black Lives Matter comes in, and I think this really amazing protest that happened in Chicago, as well as protests across the country, many Black Lives Matter chapters shut down their prides across the country. BLM Minneapolis took down their stage, and at the stage they spoke to the need for folks to fight for Black trans women. You saw folks in Black Lives Matter Toronto that took the opportunity to speak about the issues of Black trans women in particular. And so the Black Lives Matter movement has really tried to push a broad understanding of what intersectionality can look like and the practice of it, where we've seen that the mainstream LGBT movement really capitulate to sort of a white mainstream hegemony.
And this is perhaps just a chapter in the discussion that began all the way back, if you go 46 years ago, with the Stonewall riots, which were started by the actions of two trans women, Sylvia Rivera, Marsha Johnson, who essentially, you know, created this resistance that got taken up. And then along the way, the fight to essentially assimilate and to be like everyone else may have taken over the movement. And then we have the gay marriage ruling at the Supreme Court. But isn't that marriage ruling something really to celebrate?
It is. It's significant. I don't think any of us in the Black Lives Matter movement isn't talking about its significance. I think what we're trying to say, though, is while folks can get married now, which is a huge, huge deal, we are still witnessing extreme attacks of violence against Black people. And it's this conversation about citizenship, really, right? As we talk about, legalizing and amnesty for folks who are undocumented, there's also this lingering conversation about, are Black people really citizens of this country? Do we actually have full rights? And we don't. And I think that becomes this important conversation, sometimes huge argument. Sometimes it opens up a space for homophobic people, especially in the Black community, to come in and say, well, they got theirs and now we have to get ours. And we're actually saying, no, this isn't one or the other. We have to bring these conversations together.
Right. Especially given that queer Black women have been on the forefront of the Black Lives Matter movement, mm-hmm. which has been such an amazing aspect of this new mm-hmm. wave of activism that we've seen. Mm-hmm. And it seems just fitting that that is the leadership that is needed now, I think, more than ever.
Precisely. And I think it's both queer Black women, but it's also Black trans folk.
Women, yeah.
Yeah, that have mm-hmm. been at the front lines. And we've really challenged not just our movement, but every single sector of society to honor our leadership and to let us determine our own destinies. And so in the LGBTQ movement, that's the same question, right? If you look at any mainstream LGBT organization, it's mostly ran by white folks. Mm. We are not represented in those spaces.
And that's important because when we think about the, just going back to the question of what you were saying, citizenship, I made a comment on Friday when that ruling came about that now we could stop calling it gay marriage and just start calling it marriage,
right.
because that goes to the heart of LGBT folks mm-hmm. simply being treated as people,
yes,
as human beings with a full spectrum of rights. Mm-hmm. However, as you were pointing out, African-Americans in this country have never had that,
exactly.
Still are waiting for that. Undocumented folks are also struggling for it. So that question of how a court or a legal system or a government considers you a full citizen with a full set of rights is a big struggle. So for folks who are who have multiple identities, of course, we all have multiple identities, but you know, some identities stand out more than others. It's hard to keep these issues in separate boxes. We can't keep them and shouldn't keep them in separate boxes, right?
It's dangerous to keep them in separate boxes when you live in a white supremacist nation, because what happens is white folks and all sectors will always end up getting the upper hand. They will always end up leading the conversation if it's not an intersectional analysis. White people are seen as human beings, whether they're LGBTQ, disabled, children. There is something about whiteness that allows for people to see them as full humans and people to have compassion about and empathy. But when it comes to Black folks in particular, we're not offered that same compassion. We're not offered that same empathy. So it is important that we bring the folks at the margins to the center of this conversation. And we think the LGBTQ mainstream movement has large in part neglected those conversations. Mm.
Foreign policy analyst Ajamu Baraka made a really important point that in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo shootings in France earlier this year, all over the world, people held up signs saying "Je suis Charlie," including the Oscar ceremony. Where are the "Je suis" or "We are Charleston" signs? Where is that empathy?
Exactly.
For people who live right here,
yes.
And where the death toll was comparable.
Yes. I think, what's really intense about anti-Black racism is that it really, I think we're complicit in it.
Hmm.
And I think in large part, people are just so used to Black death and Black brutality. And people are numbed to that reality. Which does not allow for, I think, the same sort of need to fight as urgently, right? It's so commonplace for Black people to be killed, for Black people to be brutalized, that folks are sort of shrug their shoulders, I think, and, well, that's what happens to Black people, versus this is absolutely unacceptable and we need to fight. We all hands on deck to fight for Black life.
Yeah. Let's turn to a woman over the weekend who became a national hero, Bree Newsom, the African-American activist, musician, filmmaker, scaled the flagpole of the State House in Columbia, South Carolina, to tear down the Confederate flag. What do you make of her action?
Bree Newsom is a local hero. I think that the work that her and her community did, because it was a community effort, I want to make sure that we know that we don't want to Rosa Park her, right?
Mm.
Because we all know that Rosa Park, there was a whole strategy behind that. Rosa Park was trained for that moment. So was Bree. Bree was trained for that moment, and her community was a part of that training. And I think it was one of the most creative courageous actions we've seen thus far as a part of the Black Lives Matter movement.
And for our TV audience, you can see the video of her actually taking down the flag captured in full glory, which also speaks to the way in which social media has been employed to capture and document these actions. Now, she was immediately lionized by people all over the nation. Mm-hmm. And as you sort of implicated earlier, artists drew these superhero representations of her. And it is important, I think, for us to identify Black women, especially as leaders and heroes of the movement, right? Yeah. Or can that be a bad thing?
No, I think it's extremely important. Mm. I think as long as we are making clear that this movement is leaderful, that this movement is about all of us, and that there are many, many heroes. And as we saw with Ella Baker, as we saw with Fannie Lou Hamer, many women who do not get the shine that they deserved. I mean, Ella Baker was the architect of the civil rights movement. And she was clear about why it needed to be leaderful, why we should not have a charismatic leader that we're following. And I think we are seeing this generation model that in some of the most profound ways.
Hmm. Incidentally, the Washington Post and other newspapers did these lengthy pieces describing who Bree Newsom was. And she really is perfect. Her educational background, right. her activist background is impeccable. You know, her father was a dean at Howard mm-hmm. University. But we can't be demanding this type of perfection from all activists, right? Isn't that a slippery slope?
Of course. And the media is so wants the perfect activist, right?
Especially when it comes to Black folks.
Especially when it comes to Black folks. So she's been idealized in a way that I think she would reject as well. I think this movement has been great at saying respectability politics won't save you. We see that by the shootings in the churches. We see that by now 7 churches that have been burned.
Yes.
You know, it's been going viral on Twitter. Who is burning Black churches, yeah. right? And I think we can't allow for the respectability politics to dictate how we have this conversation.
Mm-hmm. President Obama delivered the eulogy for Reverend Pinckney on Friday, and it was very moving. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he did say, speaking of the Black church, he said, the church is and always has been the center of African-American life, a place to call our own in a too often hostile world, a sanctuary for so many hardships. And that was certainly true during the civil rights movement, and certainly the older generation of folks mm-hmm. still, you know, have that as a very important part of life. But what about younger activists? What about the Black Lives Matter movement? Are people meeting in churches? Do they see the church still as central to the community?
The church is a part of the community, but is not central to how we move or how we develop our analysis. One of my good friends, Heba Farag, who is one of the associate directors for the USC Religion Studies Department, did an article about the Black Lives Matter movement and focused on the ways in which we look at spirituality, and that it's actually really different from our past civil rights movement mm-hmm. that was very Christian focused. I think we come from, in a lot of ways, like a new agey, you know, folks who've done have sort of like found themselves in a particular way. And sometimes that could be really problematic, but I think it's, and the ways that we've reclaimed it, a healing justice narrative, mm-hmm. a narrative that actually speaks to why it is absolutely necessary for us to be whole human beings in this work, and a narrative that really calls for diverse spiritual practices to be central to our work. And so you'll see pictures of Black women saging protest, right? Or you'll see images of Black Lives Matter LA showing up to Mayor Garcetti's house, right?
Yes.
And full white garb and doing a full-on ceremony for Ezell Ford. And so we've decided that we're going to take our traditional practices and not hide them. And so I think our movement is very spiritual. You know, she asked me a question, do you feel like you're a faith-based movement? I said, that's interesting. I would never describe it as such, but I do think there's a significant amount of a spiritually led practices in this current Black Lives Matter movement.
Hmm. Obama also delivered, during his eulogy, a rendition of Amazing Grace, mm-hmm. Which was quite moving, I have to say.
I definitely cried.
Did you? I mean, what did you make of that moment? I mean, was he sincere? He has, in many ways, reflected the pain that people are feeling, but then he is the one person who has the power to do more than any of mm-hmm. the rest of us do about that
yes.
pain.
Yeah, it's he's a fascinating character in our generation, I believe. You know, first Black president. I can't even imagine the surmountable amount of pressure that he's been under. And he's also the leader of the U.S. empire, which, you know, when I did vote for him, I think I was too naive at that moment to really understand, like, oh, actually, Obama is not going to be the revolution. No elected official is going to be the revolution. But what I think he did do very respectfully is hone in on the crisis that Black folks are facing and reflect that pain and suffering that we're facing inside of this country. And as I heard him sing, I mean, that song is so powerful. I mean, yeah. It's a really self-reflective song, right? Yeah. It felt like he was actually apologizing to Black America.
A wretch like me.
Right. It felt like he was apologizing. But yeah. I don't want to then leave him off the hook. He still has, you know, a little over a year and a half to still do right by Black America.
Right. So the conversation around the Confederate flag, and I asked this of Malina Abdullah as well when mm-hmm. we'd had her on the show recently, whether it's the distraction or whether it is an important symbol. And I'm guessing that you might agree it's a little bit of both.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, this country is obsessed with making everything a spectacle. Mm. The reality is the Confederate flag is a dangerous symbol. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. I remember seeing folks with their Confederate flags on their trucks.
Really?
And, oh yeah, there's lots of white supremacist groups in the San Fernando Valley and the Antelope Valley. And I would see them with their Confederate flags, and it was an automatic sense of fear in my body. So it's terrible. And I think we do have to focus on it, but I don't think the conversation is once the flag is down, racism is over.
Right, right. And of course, then President Obama did actually explicitly call for the flag to come down, which is quite significant. And going back to the flag heroine, Bree Newsom, one of the interesting things that came out of the national attention that she got for her action was that people raised over $100,000 to help pay for her legal defense. And this brings up a really important point, that there are many Black Lives Matter activists and related folks who are facing mounting legal fees mm-hmm. around the country because they have been arrested mm-hmm. for their actions. They've been often overcharged, mm-hmm. have faced very, very high legal fees and bail money. How important is it for people to donate to the legal funds of everybody?
It's huge. We live in a country that has... the centerpiece is the prison industrial complex, and our constitutional rights have been criminalized. The right to protest has been criminalized. And so I think folks, when you see, you know, folks asking for bail funds or jail support monies, please, please, please support.
So some of those who have been struggling with that in Southern California, where this program is recorded, are two Black Lives Matter activists. You mentioned the confrontation taking place with the mayor, Eric Garcetti, mm-hmm. who has been dubbed the backdoor mayor mm-hmm. because he tried to escape from a backdoor mm-hmm. so he could avoid BLM activists,
yes.
Wanting him to do something about Ezell Ford's killing and the mm-hmm. killings of other folks. And he's taken almost no action against the LAPD. Mm-hmm. So recently, young activists Evan Bunch and Luz Flores were arrested and have now been charged. LAPD and the mayor have been trying to get these just bizarre restrictions against them. Mm-hmm. Okay, tell us a little bit about what's happening there.
Yeah, so we did an action called Follow LA Mayor because that's what organizers do. They follow elected officials until they meet with them. He should know that. That's what you sign up for. And myself and Melina went to one of the first Follow LA Mayors at the Biltmore Hotel, in which we were escorted out by police forcefully. Mm. And my arm was in a sling for a couple days after that incident.
Wow.
And then we followed him to the Raise the Wage hearing where he, you know, the sign-in, where we held up Black Lives Matter signs and signs that Ezell Ford would have wanted a living wage. Mm. And then we most recently Black Lives Matter activists went to an event where they were told it was private. They said they wanted to meet with the mayor and then literally were arrested immediately. The police say that they got in a scuffle with the police.
Don't they always say that?
Exactly. our folks say that that's actually not what happened, and they were arrested literally on site. They're saying that Evan Bunch was resisting arrest. I think they're trying to charge him with battery and assault an officer. And then they're trying to charge Luce with lynching to incite a riot because she tried to... we're not clear what she tried to do, right? But that's what they're trying to charge her with.
And the height of irony of charging this exactly. young black woman
exactly.
with lynching.
Exactly.
And let's actually explore that for a second, because that whole history of lynching, you know, which is that's what was done to the Charleston Nine. They
exactly.
were lynched.
Exactly.
And I understand that this legal charge, because I had to look into it, I was so confused.
Yeah.
It comes from if somebody apparently tries to take another arrested person out of police mm-hmm. custody, which is what white mobs did
exactly.
to black men
exactly.
in police custody historically, then you're charged with lynching. This is still on the books today?
It's still on the books.
And they're using it in this context?
Mm-hmm. There was a young woman in Sacramento, I don't know if you remember her, Malia, who was also charged with lynching. And it was huge. She was at a protest. She was a young black woman who was queer, leading protests in Sac Town, and was arrested. And they tried to charge her with lynching, and she went through an entire process. She finally, the case was dropped, but it was horrendous. It was absolutely horrendous. Lots of folks had articles on her, but yeah, this is a charge. It's on the books that our folks, Black Lives Matter members, Black people, are being charged with lynching.
And this is a way, of course, to derail movements.
Oh, of course.
Even if they know at the end of a long legal fight, charges will be dropped. They've engaged you in a long legal fight. They've
exactly.
distracted you from the work that you're doing. Mm-hmm. They've sucked all the money out of you
yeah.
and perhaps some of the soul out of
yes.
you. And it leaves you with less time and energy to actually organize.
Yes. And I mean, I want to be clear. No resident should have to do this much to meet with their mayor.
Right.
People should not have to get arrested. People should not have to follow their elected officials. Elected officials should say, you know what, this is what I'm your servant. I'm your public servant. I will have this meeting with you. And he essentially had refused. We just got word that he will meet with us. We said we will, you know, put our qualms aside to have the meeting. But it shouldn't have taken this much for us to meet with him.
Right. Now, there's also the Pasadena-based activist Jasmine Richards. She appeared on Uprising with you mm-hmm. last December. She was in studio. She, too, has been charged with terrorism?
Terrorist threats.
Making terrorist threats mm-hmm. for her work on Black Lives Matter. Again, the irony of this, what has happened with her case? And again, all of these instances, and we're just talking about the ones in Southern California,
mm-hmm.
nationwide, I mean, Ferguson, Baltimore,
yep.
Oakland, there are people who are fighting these charges or trying to fight them, don't have the money
yep.
and the legal representation. So what's the situation with Jasmine?
Jasmine's still fighting her charges. They have not dropped them. We were just in court with her last week. And it's a process. It's, you know, these are exactly like you said, this long legal process. So...
And this is a very brave young woman who is doing incredible
yeah,
work in her community.
Yeah, she's the local chapter lead in Pasadena. Just went to one of their Pasadena meetings where at least 40 to 50 Black Pasadena folks were there talking about what Black Lives Matter looks like for them.
Now, one last question on the issue of Bree Newsom and the Confederate flag. That whole discussion around the Confederate flag has, as a symbol of white supremacy, has raised the question of how people can best express their ire symbolically. Some people talk about simply burning those flags down.
There's been lots of
and
burnings.
Flag burning is a constitutionally protected form of speech.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of a Confederate flag burning?
I think that's powerful. I also think it's important that we talk about the American flag, which
yes.
is a symbol of lots of hate as well. And I've really been appreciative of Black Lives Matter members who have said, yes, the Confederate flag is a terrible symbol of a particular historical moment, but the American flag is also a terrible symbol of our particular moment. I mean, this American flag is being waved while Black people are dying every 28 hours by a vigilante security guard or police officer. So I think I appreciate the Confederate flag burning. I think it's a powerful symbol, and it's really amazing to be alive watching people burn it down. And I want to question, too, like, where are we saying then that the American flag is a symbol that we are standing by? It's not a symbol I stand by.
As we head toward the 4th of July. Now, there have also been unknown, I understand, activists around the country who've been spray painting hashtag Black Lives Matter on Confederate statues all over the U.S., especially on college campuses. Any idea who's behind that and how important a political expression is that?
No idea. I love it, though. I love what folks are doing, their imagination. I think it's a huge political expression. I just saw an image of Black Lives Matter spray painted on Columbus statue with blood all over it. And what a powerful symbol of solidarity.
And so it could be coming from anyone. We're not sure yet. This is a really, really interesting moment. So I want to turn to the fact that what you mentioned earlier, which is that churches have been burning around the country. Seventh church burning this week. This was in South Carolina, incidentally, also an AME church. And what does it signal about the time that we're living in today? Because on the one hand, people are, you know, people are spray painting solidarity signs on Confederate symbols. But then if these church burnings are indeed deliberate, which how could they not be? It's just too much of a coincidence. The backlash from people who are willing to kill is frightening, is so, so frightening.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that? How do we make sense of the time we're living in today? This is not 1950s America. It shouldn't be. We should have moved past that, but we never did.
Yeah. I don't think we make sense of it.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense, right? Senseless murder, burning down people's sacred symbols. But what we do is sort of get grounded in the reality that racism is still alive and well, and that we have a duty to fight for our freedom. And we have every sort of responsibility to be clear about what that fight looks like. And I think, you know, what's been important for me in these conversations, racism does not go away in 50 years. It can't. That takes a significant amount of work. You can't just desegregate a school and think that people are gonna stop hating Black people. I think there's, we've come a long ways, but folks are still, there's still deep-seated racism in communities, and we have neo-Nazi groups, we have KKK groups, and they exist. And if you've ever looked on their websites, if you've ever watched their videos, they completely and wholeheartedly believe that this is their country, and they will fight by any means necessary to continue that. And if Black people get in their way, they will sacrifice themselves for it.
Okay, so on that, some on the left are raising the possibility of African Americans arming themselves in self-defense. And this was, of course, the approach of the Black Panther Party. Last year, there was an interesting book published by Akinyele Omowale Omoja entitled We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement, which people have now been discussing as an idea whose time has come. I'm a little frightened by this idea because, you know, I really do feel strongly about gun violence not being a solution. But I can sympathize with the siege that people are feeling under. How do you reflect on this?
Every human being has the right to defend themselves. And I think what we've done a really interesting thing to Black Americans, which has been folks have told us to be courageous fighters as well as docile human beings. I think every human being has the right to defend themselves. Do I think they should defend themselves by the gun? That's all, you know, we have our own rights, so folks can make those decisions. But really, at the end of the day, our communities have to think about self-defense. I think it's every animal defends itself. And so to call for us to not defend ourselves or to sort of minimize that as a solution, I think is wrong. And I think we've seen some of the most powerful actions that have been nonviolent across the country that have also been a part of defending ourselves. So what I think is so powerful about the Panther Party, what was so powerful about the Panther Party was sort of coming out courageously saying it was this, you know, it was an anti-hegemonic stance to say we are going to defend ourselves from people who kill us every single day. Will that fly in the same ways during this generation? I'm not quite sure. We live in a different state. We live in a different place. I'm not sure if that's like the best tactic for us.
Right.
It was a great tactic for the Panther Party. But I do think it's all about strategy, what's best for us as Black people. I think we should decide that. But I think it's an important conversation to be having.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it would be really interesting to see how the NRA feels about this because, of course, their approach is if there's school violence in a school, arm the teachers. Exactly. So
they said the same thing about the churches.
They did. Exactly. That the Reverend Pinckney shouldn't have.
Yeah, if he had a gun.
If he hadn't vetoed a bill that would have allowed open carry in churches, he and his fellow church members would be alive today. Of course, which is completely arguable. I mean, maybe he would have been alive right. or maybe not.
Exactly.
Maybe he wouldn't have wanted to carry a gun because exactly. that's his right to exactly. not want to carry a gun.
Exactly.
Well, finally, Patrice, I want to ask you about solidarity politics, and this is something we've also tackled on this show quite a bit, and I think that's really crucial. We had had a conversation with a white activist to talk about the issue of white allies. I wrote a column on Truth Dig last week about confronting anti-Black racism in the Asian community and how that's really important. And I think a lot of non-Black Americans, particularly people of color, brown folks and others, want to desperately not stand for this anymore. Yeah. And many of us haven't been present enough. Mm. What do you hope to see? I'm not going to ask you for instruction, but what do you hope to see outside the Black community?
I always have interesting ideas, I think. One thing I've called on, and this was last night, especially after the 7th church burning, I said, white allies, I need you to take more risks. And I said, some of you really need to contemplate infiltrating white supremacist groups. And that is a tactic that many anti-racist white people have done. They've infiltrated white supremacist groups as a way to be a detail, as a way to tell other members. Imagine if there was an anti-racist white ally that was warning us before Dylann Roof showed up, right? Or warning us before church was burnt. So I think there needs to be greater risk, because the reality is just living as Black is a great risk, and then being in the movement is even a greater risk. So that is a call that I'm really serious about. I think the other opportunity for folks is to really figure out new and creative actions. I don't know if you've been following the Never 21 folks, but the folks in New York, mostly white, that have done two actions. One of them was at Forever 21, where they in Times Square, where they put Black Lives Matter T-shirts
on the mannequins,
and they just the other day they did this amazing protest that took only 15 minutes long at an upscale restaurant, where they changed the menu to the names of children, Black children who have died, and they positioned themselves as waiters, and so they came to the table with these menus that have Black children's names who have died.
Wow.
I thought that was really powerful, creative. It's not putting them in the spotlight. They've been really good about trying not to take up too much space, but also it's them challenging other white affluent people.
Well, on that note and those creative ideas, I want to thank you so much, Patrice, and I hope to continue this conversation with you in the future this movement continues. And thank you for all the work that you and other activists have been doing.
Of course. Thank you so much.
My guest, Patrice Cullors, is director of the Truth and Reinvestment Campaign for the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. She's a co-founder of Black Lives Matter with fellow organizers Alicia Garza and Opal Tometi. She's also founded the LA-based organization Dignity and Power Now. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break.